Hi, this is Allison Sheridan of the No Silly Cast podcast, hosted at podfeet.com, a technology geek podcast with an ever so slight Macintosh bias. Today is Sunday, March 21st, 2010, and this is show number 251. This is going to be a great show, mostly because I didn't have to do any work hardly at all this week. We have three listener reviews, then I did two audio interviews, and finally, of course, the world-renowned chit-chat across the pond. I pretty much did some cut and paste for the show notes is all. Let's whet your appetite with a quick tip from George from Tulsa. You know George, I mentioned him just last week about my beautiful 200th poster.
A couple of weeks ago, I connected my 16 gigabyte Nano to add some new playlists. iTunes moved over some of the music, then stopped and told me the Nano was full. That made me wonder why my 16 gigabyte Nano holds less music than my first 10 gigabyte iPod, now a decade old. Well, duh. I'm filling the new one with iTunes Store and Amazon downloads at an effective 256 kilobytes, and I've even set my own iTunes RIP preferences at the same 256K. Twice the bitrate, half the music. A 6-minute, 52-second length AAC download from the iTunes Store takes 13.2 megabytes. The same selection, converted to 256K MP3, is 12.7. But at 128K, it only uses half as much, about 6.5 megabytes. No doubt the less compressed files offer better quality. Doesn't matter to me when I can't hear a difference on my iPod, whether I'm sitting in a quiet room with an expensive headset or walking with a cheap one. Let your own ears settle the matter for you, but if you'd like more variety on your iPod, try down-converting your music to 128. The process is easy in iTunes. Just be careful not to delete your high-quality originals. I'm sending along a screen steps tutorial showing how I do it.
Thanks, George. That's an interesting tip. I'm glad you did add the disclaimer to make sure you hold on to your high-quality originals. That is an important point. With earbuds and an iPod, I bet most people can't tell the difference on the sound quality, but what if you end up piping your iTunes into your high-end stereo at some point? You'd really care about having those 256 kilobit recordings. Thanks again for a great review. And wow, how interesting. You used Screen Steps to make a tutorial for us. Of course, there's a link to that in the show notes. Next up, let's hear another great review from Lee Andrew.
Hi, Allison. It's Lee Andrew here again, this time with a review of another camera, but of a different kind. Okay, as always, there is a problem to be solved. I often Skype with friends and family nearly every day, as they don't exactly live around the bend. My main computer is a first-generation MacBook, and for many reasons, it is slowly dying on me. I still have a Windows 7 PC around that I could use with Skype, but the MacBook is the only computer with a camera that I can use live with Skype. So I decided to save some pennies and see what webcams are out there, and if there is a Mac alternative, since my old eyesight seems to freeze my MacBook every now and then. After some decent research, it seems that the Logitech Pro 9000 webcam is an excellent choice for Windows and Macs these days. Here are some highlights I think are noteworthy. The camera and software offer HD video recording and broadcasting in 720p resolution with a 2-megapixel sensor, captured detail 16x9 widescreen videos, and up to 8-megapixel photos. Face detection, to always have you on camera, no matter how much you move about. Excellent audio enhancements and elimination of feedback loops. Ultra-smooth autofocus with a Carl Zeiss lens system for sharper, fluid video. Right Light 2 technology adjusts brightness for perfect images, even in dim light. Sadly, Logitech was promising too much, and the image quality at night is not exactly excellent by a long shot. However, it is still one of the best webcam products out there. Regarding lighting, the camera is supposed to be able to compensate for overexposure even if you're sitting in front of the window, which will normally look blown out, like white glow. The so-called Right Light 2 technology does a good job if no one is in front of the camera, but if you and your friends are in front of the camera, Right Light will actually compensate for the window exposure, making it possible to see what's outside in the garden. But you and your friends will be silhouette. In other words, completely black with no details on you whatsoever. It does this every time, I thought it was supposed to not do that. Hmm. Turning the camera away, giving you less light to play with, makes the camera finally choose the right exposure, however the picture quality then looks fuzzy as if it was trying to sharpen the image too much. With a resolution of 720p and a nice Carl Zeiss lens, I would have expected way better image quality than this. So it looks like Logitech's Right Light 2 technology is as bad as webcams have always been in bad light situations. To give it a fair chance, I waited until it was late in the afternoon and used my little table lamp for a simple Skype chat. This time, using it with my brother-in-law, I asked him how the image quality on his end was like in full screen. He said with his old 22-inch Dell monitor, the quality was really good, and he was surprised it worked this well with only my table lamp. However, every now and then, autofocus would kick in and try to sharpen the image, regardless of the fact that the image was already perfectly crisp. As soon as I added another light source, the autofocus stopped messing about. Fortunately, you can turn autofocus off, which I now have set as a default since I barely ever move away from the computer. To make sure you are always visible and centered on the screen, the camera has a very good face recognition ability and zooms and pans around to keep your face in the middle of the screen, no matter how much you move about. I was really impressed with this. However, my brother-in-law kept saying that the image always looked a bit dodgy. It's no wonder really when it's zooming in with digital zoom. I suppose since it's a 720p resolution video, Logitech must have thought they could get away with it. For those that don't know the difference, digital zoom will zoom in on an image, making it look all pixelated and blurred, especially if you're too close. Optical zooms will actually make the lens physically move, so you always have a clean, crisp image. When shooting video, the camera only has 2 megapixels to play with. The quality is not bad when you have good lighting around you, especially outside, as many of you might have guessed. But when you're shooting still images, that is done with an 8 megapixel chip. Even here, the image can look out of focus despite using autofocus, but if you downsize the image a bit and send it off via email, Facebook, etc., the quality is more than okay to share quick snapshots with friends. The next important element when using a webcam is the sound. Now, most of you out there know, if you and your chat friend both do not use headphones, you will often have echoes, feedback loops with that high-pitched tone killing your ears, and other annoying sounds. Fortunately, Logitech got it right this time. I tried using my M-Audio Dynamic XLR mic instead of my Plantronics headset, and my brother-in-law used his built-in mic for this test. We were both able to speak naturally, no forced loud speaking or having to move closer to the camera or anything like that. There were no sounds from his very loud PC that I could hear, and likewise no sounds coming from my end, he said. I'm not exactly sure if incoming sound gets filtered too, but only after using the Pro 9000 camera did we both ever get this kind of clean, Star Trek-like view screen conversation going without audio problems. To try this test, I used my expensive and loud 500-watt speakers with my PC and MacBook. Despite turning up the volume really loud to a point of being nearly ridiculous, we were still able to have a normal conversation. In fact, my brother-in-law had recorded a bit of the sound on his end to show me later. Lo and behold, my voice came through loud and clear, with no hum, hissing, or other noises whatsoever. Lastly, Logitech provides their own Skype-like software, which is called Logitech Vid. You can create an account there and use it with other Logitech Vid users. Since I know no one with that software, I was not able to give it a try and cannot report on that. Now normally, just like Bart, I also throw away any Logitech CDs that come with any of their products, mostly because they're outdated, but this time I had to get it back out of the bin, as I could not find the control center for the camera anywhere on their website. For Mac and Windows, you get a nice control center for the camera itself. You can take snapshots, which get saved as JPEGs in the Pictures Home folder of the user's account on that computer. So in my case, Home folder, then the Pictures folder, and then the Logitech self-created folder called Logitech Webcam. It does this on the Mac and Windows automatically, but you can use the Control Center to choose where to save files in the future. You can record in several presets regarding the resolution. The most common are in a drop-down menu with 720p, 480p, and 360p. They even hint for what they are for and say, this is good for Facebook greeting, this is good for YouTube, etc. The control center lets you completely control the camera, not just contrast and brightness, but also what mic to use, the zoom, the autofocus, color, special effects, and sound gain, to name a few. It even lets you pan around, zoom in manually, and turn off every feature the camera offers. It even comes with a silly Hollywood effect that tracks your mouth, eyes, and head movement, so you can swap your own image completely with a different scenery, like underwater environment, and then use your face to control the face of a shark. It works surprisingly well. There are several more, but I suppose this is intended more for kids, to be honest. I am sure I missed a lot of other features here, but again, I believe I covered the most important points. I hope this review was helpful and will give you another option in case you're not happy with your built-in eyesight or you simply need a decent camera for your PC. Sadly, I wasn't able to check if Logitech had any Linux drivers or software, but I was told there are some open source drivers that apparently will work with the Pro 9000 webcam. If you do intend to buy this camera, consider buying it through Alison's Amazon affiliate link. Hint, hint. Amazon.de has it for about €80 and Amazon.com has it for about $80. Okay, until then, take care. Oh, and Alison, remember to save. And save often.
Well, Lee, I really like how that remember to save has become a kind of a mantra. It'll be like 5 years from now, I won't have crashed and everybody will still yell save. Luckily, I'm in good shape because both Mara and Kevin are in the house tonight, so they've got me covered. I'm doing pretty well. I've been saving quite a bit. Thanks also for the fantastic review of the Logitech 9000 Pro. You managed to do a great balance of rich content without getting tangled in the minutiae of a product. I actually use this same camera, by the way, at work for picture-in-picture on the screencasts I create. I've been very happy with the product, but like you, I never use the Logitech built-in software. Since I'm a neophyte at Windows, I just had someone teach me how to stop applications from auto-loading at startup just so that I could get rid of the Logitech software. It's so very rude how applications do that without asking on Windows. Pretty cranky about that. Anyway, here's an interesting thing to note. A buddy of mine, Mark Tarleton, explained some interesting things to think about when recording video from a webcam. You know how on a still camera, if you don't have enough light and someone moves, the picture gets blurred? Well, the same thing can actually happen on a webcam when you're doing video. The aperture actually stays open longer than the frame rate if you have low enough light and you can actually get blur in the video. He's so good. He did a couple of video examples for me and it was amazing how much of a difference good lighting did for the blurriness. I always thought it would only affect the brightness, and it never occurred to me it would change whether it was blurry or not. So when he told me that the lighting was coming from a $20 LED light he got at Home Depot, I went out this weekend and I bought both $20 LED lights that they had there. One is a cylinder about 10 inches tall that has three rows of LEDs in it in a grid, so it's 10 by 3, so it's got 30 lights. It's made by Commercial Electric. Oddly, I was not able to find this on the web, so I couldn't put a link to it in the show notes or even a picture of it. Don't know why that was. This thing is really intended for doing things like working on your car, but it's great for the desktop because it's powered by a lithium-ion battery, so it takes up basically zero desk space, and it isn't plugged in at all. You charge it with the included wall charger or the car charger, and it has a red light when charging, green light when it's charged. You can't actually use it very easily when it's plugged in because it plugs into the end of the thing, so you can't stand it. I carried it around all weekend looking for things to light up. The second one is what I was really expecting. It's a standing lamp with a 4-inch circular base, a flexible neck, going up to an articulated circular plate full of LEDs. Think of like a rotating makeup mirror kind of thing, and you'll get the idea of what I'm talking about. For this show, I've been trying both lights, and they give me a nice ghoulish blue pallor to my skin, which is always good. It looks like it's a bit harsh, so I've got to work on reflecting it off of some paper or something like that. That's actually what my friend Mark was doing. He said he had some white paper on the table and then he bounced the light off of that. Maybe I'll do some more experiments if the chat room lets me. They waited like 10 minutes while I goofed around with the lighting. Basically, they made me turn one of them off. But anyway. Well, Lee, again, I appreciate the great review that you did on the Logitech 9000 Pro. I agree. It's a great little webcam. Well, I've got the great pleasure of having Gene McDonald from Smile on My Mac on the show today. How are you doing today, Gene?
Hi, I'm great, Allison. How are you?
I'm doing fantastic. Well, I wanted to get Gene on the show because Text Expander just came out with the new version 3, and I'm really excited about this software. But I wanted to do a little bit of a preamble here. Gene is one of my favorite, maybe my favorite developer I've met in real life. I haven't met that many real developers, you know, representative of the developers, I should say. Mm-hmm. And Gene has just always been so friendly and fun, and I think she's kind of the darling of all the Mac podcasts. And anyway, we have a lot of fun together when we get to meet up, and she lets me give her a hard time. And I've been using Text Expander back since before Smile on My Mac actually acquired the product. It was called Text Expander back then, I think.
Yeah.
And I've always loved this show, this product. And the basic idea is you type in a couple of characters and it expands it into something bigger. So let's say your signature is real long. You can just type a couple of characters and it spits it out. There's a whole lot of different products that do this. And I've been using Text Expander for a long time, and I got really tired of how slow it was as a preference pane, so I started cheating on Gene, and I felt guilty about it, but I started using a competing product, and I felt kind of guilty about it, but I sat next to Gene at the podcast expo, and I confessed my sins and that I was why I was doing it. And every single thing I said that this other product could do, Gene would just politely go, "Yeah, we do that, Allison." I remember saying, "Well, it makes a really cute sound when it does it." She goes, "We do that, Allison." It didn't matter what I said; you had the answer that you already did that. But the reason I'm really excited about Text Expander and why I'm coming back into the fold is that it's now a standalone application. Yay!
Woohoo!
But beyond that, I wanted to let you give us an idea of what's new, why is Text Expander 3 so exciting, and why should everybody just rush out and get it?
Oh, well, you know, there's so much in it now. It's amazing. Like, when we put out a new version, you know, and go to 3.0 or something like that, it's not like a few extra things here and there and a couple bug fixes. We take our new versions really seriously, that they should be have some kind of wow factor that would make our customers want to upgrade.
A full point release.
Yes, a full point release is a full point release with us. As you mentioned, it's an application now, and that's for current users. I think that's a big improvement because, as you say, it's faster to get in and out of Text Expander. You don't have to go through system preferences anymore. And you can resize the window when you're, you know.
It's the little things like that. Right?
But and from a geek, you know, programmer point of view, you know, for my developers, they said, if we make it an application, we'll have a lot more flexibility in the future in terms of development, that being, you know, sort of caged into the system preferences of OS X prevents. So I was all for it. And I actually think that it makes it a little more friendly for new users as well, because I think those preference panes are a little bit on the geeky side, like that you have to – I don't think people – most of your listeners, of course, will understand. You know,
highly sophisticated.
The smart people that are listening to your show right now, I don't have to explain it to them. But, you know, for their less savvy computer-using, Mac-using friends – it might not be obvious, like that an application goes in an applications folder and a system preference installs itself in the system preference pane, and why that would be. The explanations are pretty geeky, and I can't say that I understand them myself so well.
And why should they have to know that?
They shouldn't, exactly. So now it looks more like an application that, you know, users will be familiar with the toolbar and the menu, and makes it easier to get into the preferences of Text Expander, because that always bugged me to have preferences of a preference pane.
Now, one thing I wanted to say was I was a little concerned that this would be a big effort for me to switch over. But when you first launch Text Expander, it says, "So, I noticed you've got this other Text Expander. Can I just take everything and shove it into the new one and we'll be done with that?" And I said, "Okay." And it was done. I mean, there was no down and no work on my part whatsoever.
Right. Well, the snippets are still stored in the same location, which is in your, you know, in your user library application support folder. So that was good, you know, not to have to worry about what happened to your snippets. But can I, as an aside, just like say that I'm you know, that worked really well for you and it works well for most people, but I'll bet you backed things up before you did that, or you had a backup that you knew you could
go
back to.
Oh boy, I should have done that, huh?
Oh no.
Well, really? I back up once a week, so
yeah, okay.
It was not too far
do that.
Out of date.
Yeah. Because, you know, these snippets are, when you work with them all the time, you really don't want to lose them. So I'm sometimes surprised.
I hate going to work because I don't have them.
Yeah. Oh, but I have a new product for you, but I'll tell you about that later. For the Windows, you're going to have to try. Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah,
sounds
there's
good.
I haven't tried it yet, so I hate to recommend it, you know, because I don't have a PC, but I'm waiting for a PC user to try it out. So maybe you'll be that person.
I'll test it. Absolutely. In a heartbeat.
But besides all that geeky stuff, the new things that are in Text Expander, it's much easier to create snippets now. You don't have to actually go to Text Expander, open it up, and add a snippet and then close it back down. There, we now have a way for you to assign a hotkey, so a keyboard shortcut, to open up a quick entry window and create a snippet from whatever program you're in. You can just create one, open that window, create the snippet, close it back, and you're done. So that's really helpful, I think, for people, you know, because you think of snippets and you say, oh, I'll have to go create that later when I have a minute, which you never do. another hotkey, which I've been really excited about, is edit the last expanded snippet. So it happens to me every day where I expand something, I say, oh, yeah. Now I have a new phone number, backspace, type. I should go copy this into Text Expander right now, but
and
I don't.
Do
it. Right? So now you can assign a shortcut, and mine personal shortcut is Control X, so last expanded snippet. And I hit Control X and it opens up a window with that snippet that I can go and make the change and close it again, and it's done. So that, to me, is huge. It sounds small, but it's really time-saving. And since Text Expander is all about saving time, we really try to make everything go as easy as possible.
Oh, Gene, that's huge, because I have one for the location of all my images for the podcast, and every week I have to change the date because I keep all my podcast images by date, and invariably I hit the keystroke and I go, oh, it's the old one. I got to change that. I'll do it later, and I fix it right. I fix it on that one, and then I do it like three times before I go, okay, this is just a waste of time.
That's interesting, because you know, Allison, we do have this built-in date macro, and I wonder if there isn't some way you could use that so the date could be variable.
Maybe, but it's a specific date that is not necessarily today's date. It's Sunday's
right.
date.
I see.
So, I mean, it's real easy, but if I could edit last macro. So did you say that was that was a keystroke you set up to do that?
Yeah. So you go into preferences, to the Text Expander preferences. There's a category called hotkeys, and there's a number of hotkeys there that you can set. And you'll see edit last expanded snippet is one of them. So you click on that. And you when you click on it, then you do your hotkey combination that you want to use. So you have to use a control, option, shift, some combination of that and another key. And like I said, I pick Control X. Everybody's welcome to copy me if they like that one.
And that'll just mess me up because I use Windows at work. I'll be cutting things at work all the time.
That's right. Yes. Then you're set. And when you expand a snippet and you say, oh yeah, that address has changed, or I want to change the product name that's in that signature, just, you know, hit your hotkey and fix it and you're done.
Wow.
So that's exciting. But then the other cool thing is this new kind of snippet, which we're calling fill-ins. So short for fill in the blank snippets. And basically what that lets you do is you create a snippet and it can have multiple spots in that snippet where you want to fill in a blank.
Oh, like a URL or something, an Ahref thing or something like that?
Exactly. For HTML tags, it's going to be killer. In fact, that's my homework this weekend. I'm going to, by Monday, you'll see there's going to be some new HTML snippets in Text Expander, because right now all you can do is reposition the cursor, you know, so it moves to the spot where you want to type something in. But if, let's just say, you know, a less geeky example, if you have a form letter and you go that goes like, "Dear blank, you know, thank you very much for sending me the blank. I will be sending you a blank on blank date. Yours truly, Gene McDonald." So you use these fill-ins, you insert them. They're in the when you create a snippet, there's a little drop-down menu of things that you can insert into your snippet, like the date or the cursor position, or nested snippets. There's a whole little menu in below where your abbreviation is filled in, and one of them that's new now, it says fill-ins, and the fill-ins can when you insert a fill-in, then you can give it a name. We just name it name, but you can give them different names. And somebody pointed out it's like Mad Libs, you know. So you could say, you know, fill-in, you know, recipient and item and order number, you know, and you fill it in. When you built that snippet, the next time you expand it, a little window opens up with blank fields where you put them, and you tab between them, filling them in, hit return, and it inserts everything all nice.
No, it does that now, or it's going to do that?
It does it now. Yeah, that's the fill-in.
Wow, where do you find that?
Well, if you have your Text Expander window open, there's a little, it looks like an insert bar with a downward pointing arrow that's right above where your abbreviation is. If you have a snippet open or you do a new snippet.
Okay, have a snippet open. Okay.
Okay. Do you see that little, in the right-hand column where there's the snippet content?
Right.
Right below the snippet content field.
Oh, yeah.
See that? So click on that and you see you have date, time, math, snippet, key. That's new too. You can actually put a tab into your snippet itself, so it can tab between fields.
Wow.
Yeah, that's, I haven't quite gotten geeked up to use that stuff, but the fill-in, so if you click on fill-in, you'll see it'll put in a little thing that says %, fill, colon, name, %. So every time you enter one in there, you can change name to whatever you want. There's a really, and of course I always learn something when I watch somebody else's videos on these. Merlin Mann did a little video last week because he was really excited about these for writing code. And you can even have, you know, fill-ins with the same name. And when you fill one in, it fills the other one in at the same time because it's the same
name. Oh, no. So, leave it to Merlin.
I know. I was like, damn, I didn't even think of that. and we will be having video tutorials for Text Expander done by our favorite screencaster, Don McAllister. Those should be out in another week or so.
Now,
so.
I noticed that you do have them still on the site, but they're the ones from before.
Right. And we left those up there because it basic, you know, stuff like of creating snippets and how to create a good snippet. And a lot of it is still valid, but it will be good when we have the new ones. But there's only so much we can do at one time. So.
You know, this has been fantastic. I'm just sitting here playing. I just created a little fill-in thing myself, and it was pretty easy to use. I guess the thing about Text Expander is it is so deep and rich that an idiot like me just says, "Oh, look, I made snippets," and moves on and never digs any deeper. So watching the Don videos really helps you go, "Oh, wow, look at all this other stuff it can do." I would have never noticed that cute little tick mark with the insert bar and clicked it. But
yeah.
Don would notice that.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And
I need it spoon-fed by Don.
Well, you know, so do I. I mean, I'm like you. I happen to know this program because I have to work with it every day. But I tend to find like the quickest, most obvious things, and I'm happy with those. And then I have to have somebody else really show me
right
the more advanced features. And I think it's better that way because really, if you, you know, your average user doesn't need those fill-ins. So they're going to, if we made it really obvious, they might get overwhelmed.
Right, right. I know I told you I didn't want to talk any longer, but I keep seeing things I want to make sure you mention is you mentioned the HTML snippets. There are, you create your own snippets, but then there's these other ones that you sort of subscribe to them, right?
That's right. They're called predefined groups, and they're snippet groups that are, they live online on our servers, and we don't tend to update them very often. They're pretty, you know, pretty complete. But if we do make changes, then since they're URL-based, the changes will get propagated to your group as well. And like I said, HTML snippets, that's going to change because, and CSS snippets probably too, because those are things that have multiple space, multiple spots where you want to enter information.
Right.
Like, you know, say an image tag, you have, you know, source, alt, height, width, all sorts of things,
yeah.
Alignment. So if each one of those was a fill-in, you could go in and just like,
awesome.
At least to do source and alt tag, because every one really should have those two things.
Yes, force them to do that alt tag.
Yeah, I know. So
the other thing is, even if, like, you're not going to remember every HTML snippet they've got in here, but let's say I want a CSS link, I can simply just hit this and I can get it. I can look at it and go, okay, now I know how to put it in and put in the snippet. I don't have to remember all of these keystrokes. I just pop open Text Expander, look it up. Okay, let's go.
Mm-hmm.
This is a fantastic product. Now, why don't you tell them how much it costs and where they can find it?
Sure. It's the new version, Text Expander 3, is $34.95. It's $15 for users of Text Expander 2 or previous versions to upgrade. And it's, you can download it at smileonmymac.com/textexpander. And the and as for the upgrade, I just wanted to point out that if you purchased Text Expander on November 1st or later, then you're entitled to a free upgrade. And
that's cool.
Yeah, but it's only $15. So
for the upgrade.
As we say, you know, how much is 1 hour of your time worth, and how much time do you save with Text Expander?
According to my statistics, I've saved 13 and a half hours at 60 words per minute, which is about what I type. So
wow.
That's and I don't know how long it's been keeping those stats, but that's definitely worth it for me.
Yeah, I'm up to 21 hours, but every so often my preferences get wiped because, you know, I'll install a new version for whatever reason, and then I lose my time, but still.
Great.
That is pretty. People love those stats too.
And oh yeah, it just makes you happy. I've saved 243,762 characters.
And you know, making people happy—that's like our company mission. So
there it is. Smile on my Mac. All right. Thanks so much for your time, Jean.
Thanks, Allison. It was great to talk to you.
Well, I did promise that I wasn't going to do any work today, and as you can see, I'm not doing any work. Now I've been saving one of my favorite reviewers for you. Here's a new review of an interesting application for jailbroken iPhones from Matt.
Hi, Allison. This is Matt Reinsmith with another review, this time of an iPhone and iPod Touch jailbreak app. It will require you to have your phone jailbroken, but I think it's very worth it. So, what's this app called? It's called Firefly Media Server. And what it does is it pretends to be kind of like a computer running iTunes. It allows you to access your music from your iPod Touch anywhere. So, if you're at a friend's house and you want to be able to listen to your music on their computer, then all you have to do is turn on Firefly Media Server, open iTunes, and your iPod Touch or iPhone will magically appear in the sidebar. Well, okay, so it's not really magical, but it seems that way when you first do it. I haven't had a single glitch with it, and I've been using it for about 3 months now. So, this app is in Cydia. You'll want to install Firefly Media Server and Firefly Starter, because without Firefly Starter, you're stuck using the web front end, and without Firefly Media Server started, you can't do much with the web front end. Anyway, as soon as you've installed Firefly Media Server and Firefly Starter, tap on the new icon with a picture of a firefly. That'll open a very simplistic window that says Firefly Media Server across the top. You have six things that you could really do in this window. You can start or stop the media server. When you start it, suddenly your iPod Touch or iPhone will appear in the iTunes source pane. Or you could stop it using the same switch. And then there's configuration. You can change the port. I highly recommend that you don't, because iTunes looks at port 3689 whenever it's looking for a DAAP share. That's the type of sharing that iTunes uses. You can change the admin password. You should do this, and this allows you to use your own password for the web front end. Also, you can change the server name. It's by default iPod or iPhone. I changed mine to MatPod because that's what my iPod is called. And you can change what directory you're serving up MP3s from. So, if you don't want your music to be served up from your standard iTunes library, you could create a new folder in your home directory or any other directory on your iPod and serve music out of that instead. Besides that, there isn't much you can do. You can tap the web front end button, but that will simply allow you to preview or use the web front end from your iPod Touch or iPhone. Now, if you want to be able to control more without your iPod Touch or iPhone, see, I keep saying this. This is a problem with having an iPod Touch. Anyway, if you'd like to control more without being directly in front of your iDevice, then you can go to the web front end at your iPhone or iPod Touch's IP address, colon, the port number that you chose. For example, on my home network, with my iPod Touch, it would be 10.0.2.3, colon, 3689. It will ask you for a username and password. In the username field, put in mobile, M-O-B-I-L-E, no capitalization, and in the password, put in whatever password you chose. That's pretty much it. I mean, there isn't really anything else you can do with it, but it's incredibly useful because you don't have to have Firefly Starter, the app, open when you're using it, so you can have it started while playing a game. You could listen to your music on your stereo through your Mac Mini. Yes, I'm kind of fantasizing there because I don't have a stereo connected to a Mac Mini, while you play a game on your iPhone or iPod Touch. And this makes it really useful. Well, thanks for listening to yet another review, and goodbye.
Matt, you come up with the most interesting applications. Nothing you've reviewed has ever been anything I've ever heard of before. By the way, you guys can all follow Matt throughout the week on his Twitter account at twitter.com/platnicat. That's PlatNicat. We asked him what it stood for, and it meant something, but I forget what he said it meant. All right, believe it or not, we have yet another recording before we go to chit-chat across the pond. You're going to really enjoy this one. Well, I'm really excited to have on the show my friend Pat. Is it Mahan or Mahan? Everybody says I'm saying it wrong, Pat.
It's Mahan.
Mahan.
Mahan? Yeah, Mahan.
Mahan?
Don't think about it. Just say it. Mahan.
Mahan.
There you go. Well, kind
of. Now, before we got on, you said think of the, it rhymes with the guy that that was against Shatner.
In Star Trek,
Khan.
Yeah.
But
yeah,
you said Mahan. Mahan's too short.
Yeah, it is. You know what? Just call me Pat.
Pat. There you go. Well, the reason I wanted to have Pat on the show was we've all been talking about the iPad and whether we're going to get the 3G or whether we're going to get the Wi-Fi model and then maybe get a MiFi. What are we going to do? And the American MiFi is fairly restrictive. You can do $15 a day or you can do $40 a month for, I forget how many megabytes, 250, 100, something like that, or $60 a month for unlimited that's not really unlimited. But Pat actually came up with an interesting idea when he came over from, you're from, live in Ireland, and you came over and brought a different solution. And I wanted to talk through that. And you gave me a lot of notes on it, so that we won't be following them exactly. But I wanted to suggest this is maybe a third way people might want to go.
It's actually a really good way to go. I use a MiFi unit that's, well, it's widely available. It's available worldwide now. But it's made by Novatel, and I think they make the Wi-Fi units that you have in the States that are branded with Verizon. And is the other one Sprint?
Yes. Yes.
Okay, well, I think they're both made by the same company, or they're all made by the same company. I think MiFi is an actual trademark name.
Okay.
But basically, this is an unlocked version.
So like you guys have unlocked phones, you also have unlocked MiFis.
It's not that we have. No, it's not. It's not. You can't walk into the store and buy it in Ireland. It's not like that. It's actually bought online from central distributors.
Okay.
That will simply ship worldwide, and it's got a pretty low price. It's about 180 euro before tax.
Okay.
Before postage, I think, which worked out for me about 220 something euro, which is approximately, well, it's
around $250, $243.
Have you done the math?
That's what Google says. 180 euros is 243.
Okay, then you got postage. All right. Okay.
Okay. The unit number is the MiFi 2372.
No, incorrect.
No. Oh, sorry.
No. Okay. There is. My MiFi unit is the MiFi. Is it 52? Are you caught me in the hop?
2352.
Right. Okay. That's the one that came out, and it's optimized for Europe. Basically, there is six different GSM signals that the carriers can use.
Oh, wow.
But you don't have to focus on it because, for instance, there is six different GSM signals that the carriers can use in the United States, of which you only have two carriers that actually use a GSM SIM, AT&T and T-Mobile.
Okay.
Three of the six radio signals, AT&T use. So basically, wherever you are in the United States, AT&T use will be used broadcasting and using a signal that this will receive and send to. So in other words, you can use their SIM.
Okay, great.
But T-Mobile do two of... They do three signals, but they only do two on this particular model. There is another model, the one with the seven in the number. You just give me the number then.
Right.
And that's optimized for the states. And basically, one of the GSM signals is different from one of ours, and it's for one of yours. It's one-third of the T-Mobile network.
Okay. So either one would work here?
Either one would work here. Either one works there. The American one is guaranteed to work everywhere on all... On T-Mobile, for instance, as we stand today.
Oh, okay. Okay.
Okay.
All right.
So I didn't go with T-Mobile in San Francisco when I met you last month because there's a possibility that I wouldn't be able to get the signal.
You heard AT&T signal was so good in San Francisco, you chose that one, huh?
AT&T actually worked fine for me.
Yeah, for data, I think it did do okay.
Yeah, it did.
Because you weren't trying to make any phone calls.
No, exactly. I was just using it for Twitter and for some Google Maps, and that was it, and that was perfect. But it saved me so much money because it would have cost a fortune for me to have roaming, data roaming on the phone.
Right, right. So how does this actually work? So you get this MiFi, the 2372 or the 2352.
Whichever you want, yeah. And unlocked units. You make sure you buy an unlocked unit, which those two numbers you just quoted are unlocked.
Okay.
So you can have it anywhere in the world.
Okay. So this would help us if we ever went to Europe. We'd be able to carry it with us and do something there too.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely. It helps you if you cross the border into Canada or wherever. I don't know if Canada use CDMA. I don't know if they use GSM. I'm not sure.
Okay.
But it helps you all around. Caribbean, Central America, South America, Australia, the whole works. You've got a little MiFi unit, the same as you have on Verizon, say, for instance. But it's you can actually open the back. I think the Verizon one is sealed, is it?
Yeah, and it's actually a little bit thinner. So I think this is one of the two that Gazmaz talked to me about quite a while ago. But yes. We had never talked about the idea of using it here, which opens up a whole new train of thought.
Yeah, well, this can be opened in the back, and the reason it opens in the back is for you to insert your SIM card.
Okay.
And the SIM card is for anybody that doesn't have an iPhone or only has an iPhone and never come across this technology before. It's a little data card that actually is your phone number.
Okay. iPhone actually has one too. You can't put an unlocked one in it.
No, exactly. But that's it. That's the little SIM goes in there underneath the battery. The battery goes in and bam. And it gives you a little bubble of Wi-Fi connectivity.
Okay.
As does your Verizon one. But the data that it's using, or rather the internet data that it's using, is through the SIM that you just put in. From wherever you get off the plane, wherever you are in the world, you buy a local SIM and go on, play as you go SIM. and just use the local connection, the local pricing, local costing. So, for instance, when I got to San Francisco, I got there late on a Monday evening. When on a Tuesday morning, I spoke to our friend Don McAllister from Screencast Online, and he also bought a MiFi prior to coming over to Macworld to be able to use it in America. And actually, he's using it to good use around England as well, because it gives him better coverage than his iPhone coverage, or better connection speeds. But basically, we got up on a Tuesday morning, we went down to a local AT&T store, and I had done the footwork, if you like, on the internet. I'd done the research, and I knew it was going to work. So we went down and asked about what was the cheapest data plan or cheapest pay-as-you-go price SIM that they would sell to us.
Right.
And the guy asked why, and we said we want to put it in this thing, and he didn't know what it was. He looked at it and was amazed by it because, you know, you don't sell them there.
Right.
So when he got over that, then he said, okay, well, we'll get this working. He worked out that $25 or $24.95 got us a new phone number, if you like, a new AT&T 3G SIM phone number, which includes 100 minutes or 100 free SMS texts or something like that, and free calls to AT&T and what have you. But, of course, we weren't going to use it as a phone, so it didn't matter to us. I didn't pay attention to those details.
It's sort of just like a base you need to pay to get into the plan.
Yeah, exactly. And then we added $20 on top of that price to put data onto it.
Okay.
And because it was an official AT&T store, he could then enable it and set it up and activate it. So for $44.95, I effectively had an AT&T phone number, SIM, with 100 megabytes of data.
And you can't buy the data plan by itself.
No, I had to have a phone number. They have to attach it to a phone number.
Right.
Because the theory is I can just top it up later on and carry on again. You know, I could put it into an unlocked phone and use it as a phone number with data.
Okay.
So this 100 megs, we worked it out. That was more than enough that I needed for Twitter and for Skype and what have you, obviously. So I said yes. Don said yeah. Okay, so we went with it. We bought it. And he instructed us that if we don't top it up, If we run out of the 100 megs, if we use up our data and we don't top up a card, but haven't used the minutes that are given, you know, the cost, that it will start to eat into that credit.
Oh, that's good, though.
Yeah, it's great. It's perfect. It's perfect. I mean, it practically guaranteed that we'd never have to top it up.
Interesting.
And I didn't have to top it up, and I lived on it because I put my phone into airplane mode. Before getting on the airplane, and never turned it on as a telephone in the United States, because one data hit, and they would have carte blanche to just
All of a sudden it cost you a house payment, right?
Yeah, exactly. You get back here and they give me the line that AT&T have charged them, when really AT&T wouldn't have charged them at all. It would have just been a minimal fee, but O2 in Ireland would then have stuck me for whatever. You know, X amount of dollars, you know. So it was really, really small. The minimum data plan that I could put on the iPhone prior to going was €150.
Okay.
It was like €50 per month, but I had to buy 3 months' worth.
Oh,
even
geez.
Though it's going for a week.
A week, right. So all of this costs you, so this is $45 a month, and it, let's say you were going to be here for a couple of months, you would have to pay $45 a month, right? You have to pay $25 and the $20?
No, I'd have to just pay $20. Well, I'd have to pay.
Oh, so the $25 is just like to buy in, and then
I think the $25 gives me my phone minutes and text.
But like, let's say if I was going to do it, I'm going to use it for a year. Do I have to pay the $25 and the $20 every month, or just the $25?
I can't ask you that, but any AT&T worker can, because that's. I never thought to ask that, knowing that I was going away after a week.
Right. That would make a big difference, because if it was really pay-as-you-go minutes and I don't need any more minutes, then all I care about is the data plan, then all of a sudden it's $20 a month.
Well, here is the thing. Your minutes and that will carry over.
Mm-hmm.
Given that they're going into a Wi-Fi unit, they're not going to be used.
Right.
Your data would have to be topped up.
Sure.
That only lasts 30 days.
Okay.
So So that doesn't carry over.
That's okay though, because that's only $20 a month, and
that's right. So if and when you needed to have this thing active, mm-hmm. go on a trip with your iPad, which is what you're thinking of,
right?
You'd have to top it up by $20 the day before, or that morning, or whatever the case is.
Right. So how do you
confirmed?
Do you know how you top it off? I mean, do you have to go to the store to do it, or can you activate it over the phone or?
Well, given that it's a phone number SIM, mm-hmm. the theory is that you'd have it in your phone, and what you do is you make a data call or you make a text call to customer services on the phone.
Oh, okay.
And say I've just bought. I think it's all automated. And what it is you'd say you bought this top up, which basically is going in and buying a PIN number in the shop.
Right.
And in the store, and then you come back and you type it into your phone, and you go through the automated service, and they'll tell you punch in your 16-digit number now, and boom, 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 and then they'll confirm the fact that it's topped up to that amount. What you would have to do if you're going this route for the iPad is you'd have to have a phone that you could put the SIM in to do that.
Yeah.
Or walk into a store when you buy it in an AT&T store.
Or possibly, I wonder, you might even be able to do it online.
Okay, there you go.
Possibly,
Perfect. But if it's a case that you've got to go into the store, you just hand them the SIM and say, top this up, because you know, you're not using it in the phone, you're using it in a MiFi unit.
Now, interesting enough, this is the plan that Rose did when she came over from Australia. My other friend Pat Dingler gave her an unlocked iPhone, and we went over to AT&T and we bought a SIM card for $25 plus the $20 for the data, and the data wouldn't work. And when we went back to AT&T, they just said, "Yeah, that won't work." And we said, "Okay, give us the $20 back," because we told the guy why we were buying this, and they just said no.
Yeah, were you in an actual AT&T store,
yeah.
or you just
a real okay. AT&T store? So, yeah, she got screwed for $20 on that, but she was able to text message and have a phone at least, so that was good.
Well, the guy's initial reaction when we walked in was he's kind of shaking his head. He didn't know what way to point us, you know. Mm-hmm. And I assured him that he wasn't sure it was going to work or anything like that. And I assured him that I knew the system, I knew it would work,
right.
And I knew there must be a product that he has that he was unaware of, because nobody's come in for this before. So I said, that's
sure.
okay, let's work it out. So he said, right, the cheapest thing we can give you is, and he went through it and gave me what I just told you. And I said, yeah, we'll go with that. You know, so he went away to get the SIMs, and I said to Don, great, we've cracked it. And Don says, well, it hasn't worked yet. And I was like, no, it'll work, Don, it'll work, you know. So, and it did, it's great.
Don's such a prove it to me kind of guy, right?
Well, I suppose it's, you know, it's just his approach. But he was going on my word and what he'd
sure.
heard. I actually did the research and knew it would work, so that's the difference.
So this isn't a better deal just straight financially. Let's say for an American, if you only have to top off the data at $20 a month, that's $20 a month for 100 megabytes. Where if you buy an iPad with the 3G, it's $15 a month for 250 megabytes.
Yeah, if and when, and no contract. Obviously, there's no contract in this either. The thing is, if you're going to stay in California, I thought about this because I knew you were going to ask me about this. If you're going to stay in California and only travel with your iPad in California or any other device that you want to connect to a MiFi unit, mm-hmm. and you don't want to go with the Verizon contract because you've already got a phone contract as well and something like that, then you'd probably be better off with the 3G version. Yeah, yeah. And I'm actually starting to think that over here as well, that it's primarily the iPad that I buy, the first one that I buy, will be for the family, it will be for my son, and my wife will be using it with my son. And he's special needs, so I want to get him like a giant iPad, an iPod Touch.
Oh, cool! That's a great
yeah.
idea.
Yeah, so this is the thing I've been waiting for. When I first see the iPod, I thought this would be great in a computer. I actually said that 2 years ago, you know. But
if it just was bigger,
yeah, if it just was bigger, right? So you could use more than one finger and you could use hands. So anyway, so that's why I'm initially buying it. So I've been thinking the last couple of weeks, and I actually thought, you know what? The MiFi is not always going to be with the wife. It's only got 4 hours battery life. I mean, I had to go out and buy an external battery as well.
That's right. You showed me that.
Yeah, cool little thing. But I just thought to myself, you know what? Maybe just to have it just working, if they come out with a similar data plan over here as they're offering in America, i.e., no contract, $15, 50, you know, that's approximately €10 over here, €10 or €11.
It's a pretty reasonable deal.
It's fairly good. Even as we speak, we have pay-as-you-go plans similar to the sim that I bought in America. That is 20. If I top it up by €20 a month, you know, within a 30-day period, anytime I want to connect to the internet, it simply uses 99 European cents per day for that internet connection.
Oh, wow, that's nice.
Yeah, but it's limited to 200 something megs or 250 megs or something. But for incidental surfing or, you know, as long as you're not downloading files.
Yeah, yeah. So I think what I would probably be likely to do is to buy one of these MiFis the next time I go to Europe, which is, in my case, is like every 5 years. Or actually, I don't have a pattern yet since I've only been there once. But
if you go to the Caribbean, if you leave the States, if you go to an area where you don't have your regular AT&T coverage, if you have an iPhone at the moment, and you go elsewhere, say up to places like Minnesota. I know we got a mutual friend in Boniface, Julie Court. She's up there, and she can't buy the phone because of her coverage.
Right.
So you would need something that you don't normally use because it's not worth getting a contract. Right. For those incidental trips. So possibly an unlocked unit like this would be the way to go. Because if you get off the plane anywhere else in the world, you can also use it.
Yeah, yeah. I think what I'll probably do is wait until before I go someplace else and then buy it then. And just to have it, like you say, it sounds like a great deal. Well, yeah, I think I finally get it, Pat. This will be the third time I've tortured you about this to explain how it works. And I think I really do understand it now.
Yeah, it's basically what happened to me when I came home. I don't know how much data Don used. When I came home to Ireland, the coincidence would have it that one of my clients over here was going to Las Vegas the following week. And he had his own Wi-Fi unit. We actually bought them at the same time. And I simply handed him the SIM and I said, that'll give you coverage for the week you're in Vegas.
Oh, that's great.
And it did.
So now it only costs $25 a person for their trips.
Well, yeah. I mean, I didn't charge him. I just gave it to him. And he came back and he handed it to me. He says, what do you want to do with this now? I said, put it in the dustbin next to you. Because now it had to be topped up within 90 days or the number dies. The phone number itself dies.
Because
I said to the guy, when I come back next year, MacBook next year, do I use this SIM? He said, no, if you don't top it up, it won't work. But just come in and buy another SIM. I said, yeah, right, exactly.
Yeah.
Well, so that's it.
This has been great, Pat. And for anybody who's listening, Pat is on the new Blue Yeti USB microphone. And I don't know whether your voice would have that wonderful lyrical Irish accent that he's got, but it's certainly got some great depth. It sounds like a great mic, Pat.
Thanks. Yeah, it's a little bit more of an English accent than Irish.
But English. Okay.
Yeah. I'll forgive you.
I'm sorry. I don't know. But you're in Ireland, right?
No, I am Irish. Yeah, it's
just, you're Irish.
I have an accent that confuses people. I'm sorry. So between my name, my accent, my location.
I have no idea what you're talking about. Right?
You don't know who you're talking to.
Well, I really appreciate the time, Pat. And anytime you can come back on the show, I'd sure like to have you.
Alison, you're more than welcome. It's been a blast. Thanks for asking me.
That was so much fun. I hope Pat comes on the show again. I really enjoyed talking to him. He is such a sweetheart. Well, can you imagine the peace of mind Steve and I have about our cars? Maybe you get that peace of mind by buying new cars frequently because you hate the stress of an older car. You worry constantly that something could fall apart at any moment and it'll be such a huge hassle to deal with it. With Honda Bob, we get our regular maintenance done at our house so we can catch anything well before something catastrophic goes wrong. As our cars age, they do need more repairs, but it's not a huge hassle. In fact, it's very little hassle at all. Bob drives on over, fixes us right up, and doesn't cost us an arm and a leg. Bob keeps track of how much money you spend with him, so you can tell at any moment how much your car has cost you to own. And trust me, our cars cost us hardly anything when Bob takes care of them. It's amazing how little we spend on our cars. It's a few thousand dollars in like 8-10 years. If you live in the LA or Orange County areas and you drive a Honda or an Acura, give Honda Bob a call at 562-531-2321 or send him an email at hdabob@aol.com. HDA Bob's mobile service is not affiliated with Honda, Acura, or Honda Worldwide. Well, it's that time of the week again. It's time for chit-chat across the pond on a Wednesday?
I was just going to say, you're saying that time of the week. When's the last time we actually had a normal recording time?
This is weird. Yeah, it's nighttime for me. It's midnight for you. It's work. This is going to be weird. Are you sure we can do this?
Yeah, I'm sure we'll muddle through. It's St. Patrick's Day here, so I've had the day off work.
Oh, right, right, right. Not us. Working stiffs. But anyway, let's go ahead and
get... If you get the 4th of July, it all evens out.
That's true. That's true. All right, let's go ahead and get started. What do we have on Security Light?
First off, we can say that I was kind of right. I had predicted that Adobe would screw something up while we were away. Can I say that?
Yes, yes, that's okay.
Okay. And they kind of did and they kind of didn't. So they didn't actually release anything new and they didn't fix any new problems, but they did release a warning to people that the old problems they fixed only very recently are in fact being actively exploited, so you really, 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 really do need to patch.
Well, that was nice of them to remind people.
Yeah, the strange part about this story is that Microsoft did the research that brought it to light.
Oh, really?
So it's almost like neener, neener, neener. I'm not quite sure how that works.
And then your link to it is in macworld.co.uk. So we just get off the whole family involved.
Yeah, well, the Macworld article actually is really well written, so that's why I chose that link.
Okay.
But yeah, if you're using any of the PDF products, so that would be Acrobat and Reader on Windows, Linux, Mac, Unix, whatever you're having yourself, update, 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 update. Or if you're on the Mac or Linux, consider alternatives. Actually, even on Windows, consider alternatives.
Right. Wow.
Yeah, get that cruft off your system would be my personal advice.
All right.
In what I consider to be slightly sad news... my favorite browser version is no more. It's no longer Safari 404.
Oh, I didn't even
catch
nerdy, that.
But I really liked 404.
I didn't even notice, and it's gone already.
I pointed it out when we did it in chit chat across the pond. But anyway,
really?
Yeah, it was my running joke for a week on every podcast I was on. So now we've gone to 405, which fixes, I think it was 16 fairly substantial security updates. So no matter how fond you are of 404, update, update, update.
Well, at least 405 is the name of a freeway here in L.A.
Does it go anywhere nice?
It goes to Northern California.
Is there wine there?
Yes. There
Sounds
we
good
go.
To me.
Well, would you believe I think I've actually already done the update? Yes, I am. I'm running 405.
Excellent.
Pat me on my little pumpkin head.
I did mine yesterday. I hate the fact that you have to reboot, but I understand why, but I still hate it.
Yeah, why do we have to reboot so much? We had a whole show on that, though, didn't we?
We did.
I still don't like it.
No, it's still exceptionally annoying. But there we go. The final thing we have in Security Light is just bizarre. So, believe it or not, if you have an Energizer USB battery charger and you loaded the software, you may actually be in trouble.
So this is a certain kind of battery charger.
This is a battery charger that plugs into the USB port and comes with some software so you can see how well charged your batteries are through the software.
Does it also charge the batteries via the USB power?
As I understand it, yes. But
oh, okay.
There's no photograph of it in the security details. Basically, they seem to have made a slight boo-boo in their QA process, and a backdoor Trojan has snuck into their software.
This reminds me of when the iPods actually had that, remember?
It did happen once or twice where a virus got in, yeah.
Yeah, and then there was one on the digital picture frame. Some of them had it.
Yeah, that's quite common.
So anything you stick in your USB port?
Careful.
Jeez. So is there a solution to it?
Don't install this software would be one solution. What it does is it installs a backdoor that listens on TCP port 7777. That should be 4.7s.
Okay.
So if you have your Windows firewall turned on, this is Windows only, by the way. If you have your Windows firewall turned on, you're all good and hunky-dory because they can't get in. And if you're behind a home router and you don't have that port mapped through, then you should be absolutely fine as well because there's no way for them to actually hit the back door then.
Okay. So if you did, if you were unknowing, unwitting about this, you'd most likely get hit or most likely not get hit?
It would depend on how you're accessing the internet. In this day and age, I would say most likely not, because almost everyone has home routers now, which provide a wonderful layer of protection.
Okay.
Anyway, yeah, it's still a pretty nasty one, though, because if you do have it and someone does try to connect in on that port, they basically can do anything they like on your machine.
Yikes. Hey, they're only $14.
Yes.
Maybe as Mac uses, we should go get them. You can get them used for $9.
Used and abused. Anyway, yeah, really. Just one of the stranger ones. It's not often that I see Energizer USB charger come up on the US cert. It's just not normal.
Definitely. Well, I just checked in. Yes, it does charge via USB port. That's kind of a cool idea, actually.
It's handy if you're out and about. If you know, if your camera takes AA batteries or whatever.
Yeah, yeah. All right, anything else in Security Light?
That is all that crossed my radar. And actually, just to mention, you know, I've been saying, you know, assuming NetNewsWire hasn't messed up again.
Yeah.
Turns out it has.
Uh-oh.
It started to just randomly forget feeds. It keeps them. It just never sees an update. Someone can post 500 messages to that feed and it will never, ever show up in NetNewsWire. I'm convinced it has something to do with the syncing to Google. So I did an export of my feeds in OPML format, nuked everything, and then started afresh, fresh plists, fresh everything, and did not let it contact Google, did not do any syncing whatsoever, and I'm now using Dropbox to sort of kind of sync it.
Oh, dear. Yeah. What a mess this has been for you.
It really
and for
is.
For everybody else.
It's such a pity that no one has actually come up with as good of a RSS reader in terms of the ergonomics of the reading, because otherwise I'd switch in an instant. But I've tried, and none of them are as usable and as friendly to power users as NetNewsWire.
I don't know. It didn't sound so friendly lately.
It's just the syncing.
So it's a real friendly interface, except the data's not there.
I know. But I really have tried other stuff, and I keep going back to it. And I keep swearing at it, but I keep going back to it. So hopefully now that I've taken this Google rubbish completely out of the equation, I'm hoping for a smoother ride.
All right. I sure hope so. Otherwise, we won't know what's going wrong in the world.
Yeah, that is true. Now, I was just realizing that every week I was getting less and less and less news items. I thought, the world isn't getting less interesting.
And that was your first clue, huh?
Yeah, that was my first clue. It's like, there's been nothing happening in security this week. Wait a minute, that doesn't happen.
That can't be it. All right, well, let's kick in our main topic. Jonathan wrote in with an interesting topic, I thought. He had asked a question. He said, I have a question for you and Bart. I'm now 14, so we'll have to start thinking about career choices soon. Bart talks regularly on the show about his job and what he's doing. Sounds great. I was wondering if you could give me and the other listeners an insight about what you do at the moment and what it involves. First of all, Jonathan, great time to be thinking about that, and really well-written letter, I thought. So we thought we'd poke at Bart's job and how he got there and what kind of influences in his life got him into this nonsense. And I thought it sounded interesting, too, because I've actually never heard much of the story. So what do you do? How did you get that job?
Okay, that's two different questions. Where do we go first?
Anywhere you want to start, Bart.
Well, I guess I got into my job by accident. That's most things. Actually, I got into this whole computer lark by accident. We had, thankfully, I think now, this seems to be changing, but when I started college, the degrees were very open-ended. So I went into an omnibus science degree, and the only thing that was set in stone was that I would be doing science over the next 4 years. Hmm. I had a lot of choice of subjects, and I had, in my mind, I had intentions to do, I wanted to become an astronomer, so I thought I'm going to do physics of every sort I can get my hands on, and then try to get into astronomy as a grad course or something.
Okay.
But I had to get four subjects, and maths was compulsory, so that's one down. Then there was experimental physics and mathematical physics, so that's
that
three
sounded
down.
Like fun.
Yeah, more on that later. And then I needed a fourth, and I knew I hated with a fiery passion chemistry. Myself and chemistry have never seen eye to eye.
You know, if we could do that thing where we punch knuckles, you know, dude, I'm with you on that one. Hate chemistry.
Yeah, I don't know why. It's just if I had a teacher that wasn't good at it or something. I don't know. But me and chemistry just never saw eye to eye.
And here I am in a family full of chemists.
I was going to say, it doesn't seem to have been genetic in that way.
Well, I think they got it from Steve's side.
Ah, okay. So he likes all those shells and stuff.
Yeah. I liked balancing equations, so it was all downhill after that.
Yeah, that bit's easy. It's sort of mathematical.
Exactly.
And then another choice then was biology. And I was like, that just involves learning stuff off. I don't care how many phylums there are and how many kingdoms there are and which bit goes in what and what bit of Latin goes where. It's like learning off has never been my strength. I want something I can understand and get my teeth into, and biology just really doesn't float my boat in that way.
We got a new phrase there, Bart. I haven't heard that before. Learning off?
Rote learning.
Okay. Pound cultural differences, Rose.
Okay, I thought that was... So what would you say if you had to learn...
Memorization?
So, memorization, okay.
Yeah. Learning off. I got a learning whole new off. Phrase. Okay.
So that left one choice, computer science.
That was the last of the four?
That was it, yeah. That was the only available choice. So I thought, I like playing computer games. I'd know my way around DOS. I can do computer science. So I figured, you know, I'll do computer science for 1 year and then I'll keep on the physicses and I'll drop maths at the first chance I get and that'll be fine because I don't like maths that much. And after first year, it soon became abundantly clear that mathematical physics and me were not going to be friends. I passed with pretty good marks, but it's a very strange department. It's a very teeny tiny department in the university, and the actual head of the department, the prof, gives the lectures to first years to try and entice them in, trap them in his net. But he's very honest about it, and he says, my first year course is dead easy. Everyone passes it. But there's a second module in the second half of the first year that gives you a taste of what it's really like in mathematical physics. It's only worth 25% of your marks, so it's not going to fail you, but it gives you an idea of whether you want to do this in second year. Oh my God, did I hate that module.
That's a fair way to introduce it, though. That's kind of cool. Like, get you suckered in so you're kind of comfortable with it and then tell you what's coming.
Yeah. I was really, really fond of that professor. He was a bizarre chap with a massive afro of bright red hair. But really, really nice guy. And he was very honest about it. And I really enjoyed his courses, but I got an honest opinion of what was coming. And I said, no, sorry, this mathematical physics thing isn't going to work. I said, I know, I'll keep on that experimental physics stuff. It's like, well, if I'm dropping mathematical physics, then I got to keep that computery stuff on too. So I did. And as time went on, I soon found that the experimental physics sounded an awful lot like the mathematical physics. I have no idea what a del operator is, but I'm supposed to. I struggled on with the physics. I kept it on right to the end of my degree. But the more mathematical it got, the less me it got. And the more I did computer science, the more I loved it.
Now, in computer science at that point, though, aren't you doing a lot of programming?
First year computer science is all programming, or it was in my day.
Right.
And that's not necessarily true anymore, which is a slight bugbear.
That is a good point, Jonathan, because if you get my perspective, then Bart's perspective, yours might be completely different when you get there.
It's something that's really, 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 I think, is a disastrous idea. They were losing too many students in computer science. So rather than try to do a better job of teaching it or accepting the fact that not everyone is made to be a computer scientist, they decided to make first year easier and sucker people in. So away went the programming in first year, and in came the history of computer science. Another such hand-waving series. And then in second year, when you've chosen it again and you're stuck, they wallop you over the head with programming. And if you're the kind of person who's just not a programmer, like I'm not a mathematician, you're stuck. I think it's really mean. I really, 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 really can't say how much I think it's a bad idea what they do.
Oh, yeah. You ought to dig in.
Yeah, so, I mean, what used to happen is the first lecture would be on programming and we'd dive straight in, and by the second lecture, about 25% of the students would have decided, you know something, that physics looks great. But, you know, it was honest, it was realistic, it was fair.
Right, right, right.
So, but I really, really got into computer science then when we got to fourth year. Because in our system, I went to college pre what we call modularization. So if you did first year physics, that meant that you did this course, then this course, then this course, then this course. And you had zero choices, and you did them in that order. You did them within 1 year, and there was one set of exams at the very end of the year.
Okay.
The old fashioned. When we got to fourth year, was our first taste of modularization. We were told, if you're doing double honors, you need to have, I think it was 10 modules by the end of the year. Mm-hmm. Here are the following 20. Have fun.
Yeah, you know, that's what my kids are living with right now, or Lindsay did, and now Kyle is, and I don't know if I like that.
No, it was just absolute heaven for me, because I was, you know, computer science is such a broad subject, and to be able to just pick in, and what was really great about the fourth year stuff was the people lecturing it were doing research in that area. So we had a guy lecturing us AI who was doing his PhD on AI. You know, the guy really knew his stuff. He made it really interesting, made it, you know, it was just a great course to do. And it wasn't just something he was lecturing, it was something he was passionate about and lecturing. And that was the case with an awful lot of the subjects. So when you get it taught to someone, when you get taught by someone who's so passionate about their subject, it's really nice. It's very pleasant.
Yeah, that's true.
And there was
true.
Some, you know, one course that has had a lasting effect on me is human-computer interaction, which is hence my obsession with good interfaces.
Ah.
That comes down to fourth year. So, you know, in the end of the day, I ended up with a science degree with a double honors. I don't know. So basically a joint major, I think is what you'd call it.
Double major.
A double major.
Right.
In experimental physics and computer science.
Wow.
And you might imagine that because I've ended up as a sysadmin, that the computer science degree is really the important part of that. That's not really true.
Okay.
The skills I need on a day-to-day basis, I didn't learn in a lecture hall in computer science. I learned a lot of the right thinking in the whole science degree, but the actual important stuff I learned by getting involved with the IT society and volunteering my time with them.
Give us a little flavor of your world of what being a sysadmin is. I know what it is, but for the audience, what that actually means.
I think it's probably one of the most varied jobs in the world. It depends somewhat on the kind of organization you're in. The one extreme is that you're it. You're the entirety of IT. You're in a small organization, and if it has a lead, it's your problem.
A lead is a wire?
Yes. Okay. Yeah. If it plugs into a socket, it's your problem.
Okay.
The other extreme would be a very large organization, you know, with many hundreds of thousands of employees. And in which case, if you're a sysadmin there, you'd probably have a really, really narrow list of things that you do. You might be the guy who looks after patching the Windows server that does something or other. I mean, you could be very specialized.
Mm-hmm.
But the average is that you tend to have fairly small IT departments. So you tend to have only a few sysadmins, and those sysadmins have to do an awful lot. They have, you know, their responsibilities and what they're doing is very, very varied. So if you're the kind of person like me who gets bored doing the same thing all the time, being a sysadmin is great.
Now, so, do you work with users directly very much?
No, never. It's great.
See, most of the sysadmins I know went into that job because they love helping people. They like solving problems, being the hero that cracked the code and figured out what the problem was.
Okay, it may be different in some places, but where I work, we have sort of a, you know, we have user support who deal with the people, and then if anything needs to come back to the sysadmins, and we deal with user support who deal with the people.
That sounds a little bit like the that movie Office Space. I'm good with people.
Well,
I'm a people person.
I find computers less argumentative than people.
I don't know. I've heard you have a few arguments with computers.
That is true.
Less argumentative.
Less argumentative. Yeah, differently argumentative.
Okay.
I mean, it does often involve with dealing with other technicians and stuff. I mean, it's not that you never deal with people.
Right.
But you tend not to be dealing with the Microsoft Word can't see my printer.
Right.
That's not what sysadmins do. So I actually listed in the show notes the kind of stuff I do, and I kind of surprised myself that I ended up with 7 points, and none of those 7 points are particularly small.
Hmm.
So my week is sort of broken up into managing existing systems. So any organization is going to have a whole batter of IT infrastructure. And I haven't got an exact count, and even if I had, I probably wouldn't share it. But we have on the order of about 60 physical servers and about 30 virtual servers. So we've somewhere between 90 and 100 servers,
mm-hmm.
which provide many different services to many different departments, et cetera, et cetera. And they all need to be kept going. So just because you set them up and put them in a data center doesn't mean that that's it, you're finished. So all the day-to-day stuff, a lot of it is updating operating systems, updating applications, that kind of boring stuff that, you know, we have to do as desktop users every time there's a new version of Safari. You have to do that on a server too, but things get a bit more complicated because you can't have downtime apart from certain windows, and you have to be much more careful about which patches you apply and which patches you don't apply. But the basic idea is you got to keep the stuff that's there going, and that's not particularly exciting work.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, a good security podcast in your ears, you're rocking. Then the other not-so-interesting stuff is you have to manage the services that you have. So as well as just keeping them running, you have to do things. You got to create accounts for people. You got to create network shares. You got to increase their quotas. You got to add new machines to the network, stick them in the domain, give them a DNS name, add them into the HTTP service, create a new website for someone, add some stuff to the reverse proxy, throw up some redirects, yada, yada, yada. You know, you got to do all these kind of changes that come and go all the time. And that's not all that exciting either. And that does tend to involve talking with real human beings.
Ugh, that's horrible. Yeah.
But then you get into the much more fun stuff, and something that may surprise people, but I spent a fair bit of time programming. When you're in a large organization, you tend to have lots of different systems. So I work in a university, so obviously we have a system for managing student records, and then we have a system for managing the staff payroll, and then we have an e-learning system, and then we have a bunch of other systems, and on some level they do all need to communicate with each other. Because the e-learning system needs to know what student is doing what module, but that's all inside the student record system. But the student's record system was made by one company and the e-learning system was made by another company, so they don't actually talk to each other. So you've got to program in a sort of a layer of glue between the two, which allows them to communicate in whatever ways they need to communicate. And a lot of that stuff would be written in scripting languages or Perl or things like that.
And that's so fun?
Challenging.
Okay.
Challenges are fun.
Okay, right.
No, it certainly exercises the brain an awful lot more than the other two points do. And it's very important work. And when you end up with it all, you end up with a nice, smooth system. And it's kind of a thankless job in one respect, because no one actually realizes how much work goes into making everything just work.
Right.
But there you go.
But if you don't hear from them, then you did it right.
Yeah, exactly. And sometimes people assume you did it far better than you did. But anyway. Well, no, we have people who go in and register, and then they expect that 2 seconds later, everything on campus knows that they've changed the modules, which isn't how it works, because there'll be some job running at midnight that synchronizes two databases. And then by the next day, sure, but you know. Anyway, the other fun stuff is project work. So you have a bunch of systems up and running, but they are not going to be those systems forever. So you've got new stuff coming in, there's whole new technologies come out, or you just have to do a major upgrade where you completely change how you do something. And so you set up a big project for it and involves a lot of research and finding out what's best practice and what choices are available, and often costs will come into it, and so you end up having to really think through a problem and come up with the best possible solution and then implement it and get it out there and get people using it. That is certainly very rewarding stuff. So that's what I call project work.
So are you actually making the decisions or making recommendations on what the next big thing should be?
No, management come up with those kind of things. So management may decide that I think our email system needs to be the focus of a major upgrade, for example.
Okay.
At which point it gets handed down to the sysadmins. Go, right, what do we need? Why do we need it? What's the best out there? What would you suggest? And how much does it cost? And then, you know, management will then make a decision and say, well, it does sound great, that Uber fancy mega system, but you do realize that we don't have 40 squillion euro lying around, so you're going to have to make do with this other one. Yeah.
Right.
And there's back and forth and all these kind of things. But, you know, the priorities tend not to be the sysadmin's role. That's your manager's role.
Okay.
Another one that's often challenging, though not necessarily fun, is you do end up having to respond to security incidents. Something happens, and you have to find out what happened, what was affected, how did it happen, and if it broke something, you've got to get it fixed. And those aren't always in agreement with each other. Figuring out what happened and getting it fixed quickly are not actually possible at the same time.
So I don't see on your list working those security issues up front of doing things to secure the network, for example.
Well, that's sort of covered in point 7, kind of.
Okay.
Security isn't something that happens after. It's something that happens at every point in the process.
Right.
When you're rolling out a new project, if you haven't, if you don't, aren't thinking of security the whole way through that process, you're going to make a mess of it. So it's not a separate thing. It's completely an integral part of how we do everything.
But sometimes there's actually projects wrapped around, we're going to do this to secure, make our network a bit more secure. Sure.
I mean, you have all sorts of systems which, say, monitor all your network traffic, and then they keep an eye on what's sort of the normal pattern, mm-hmm. and then they look for changes. It's like, okay, so on a normal day, you do 40 gigabytes of TCP traffic and 4 megabytes of DNS traffic and so much email traffic. And then today, you did 5 terabytes of HTTP traffic. Obviously, something's gone horribly wrong somewhere.
Right.
And so you'd have systems that would just sort of look at the patterns, and then they'd send you an alert to say, look, there's something way out of whack here. And then you as a human being with a brain has to actually dig in and figure out what's going on.
But you might also be put in a position to put in that system that does that monitoring, that you figure out we need a system like this. And that would be back to the project kind of work.
Oh, absolutely. Those kind of things are major projects where you need to put in monitoring, and you need to put in, I mean, there's a million and one different things you do to secure your network. They often involve talking about real people too, because inevitably security inconveniences someone. They're often not impressed.
Right.
We sort of get in a bit of trouble. Well, not trouble, that's not the right word, but a lot of universities have a reputation for being exceptionally open. And they're, you know, a lot of universities are targeted by hackers because they have a reputation of being exceptionally open. We tend to get a lot of stick internally because we tend to do things a little more enterprising, a little less university-y. So we're more locked down than your average university, but I'd say we're still less locked down than most industry, because there's an awful lot of stuff that's legitimate in an educational institution that's absolutely not legitimate in a corporation.
Okay. So...
Society.
Right, right. So,
you're definitely responding to security incidents where you're playing detective, you're repairing things, and you're also, a very important part of that is prevention. So you found a problem that happened once. What are you going to do to make sure it doesn't happen again?
Right.
Then some of the less fun stuff, again, is contributing to policies.
I was looking for something like that.
It has to be done. I mean, you have to choose as an organization what your policies are going to be in terms of quotas and firewalls. And I mean, you have X amount of resource and you have to share that out in a fair way. But you also, you need to give people as much access to the internet and stuff as possible so that they can do, I mean, education is always at the cutting edge. So you don't want to be stifling people's exploration and people's legitimate experimentation. But on the other hand, you don't want to walk in one morning and find that every single workstation in the place has been hacked.
That's a bad day.
Oh, yes. Actually, well, I think the worst day where we come in one morning and not a single machine could actually get on the network.
Oh, my gosh. Seriously?
Yeah, there was a rogue DHCP server.
Nice.
Yeah, so everyone was getting... So that took a fair bit of detective work to track it down and then slap someone very severely across the wrist. I mean, and you do have those kind of bad days. And sometimes they're your fault and sometimes they're not. Sometimes you're lucky, you hear down the grapevine that another university has just been completely hammered by Configure, and you immediately go look at all your monitoring stuff and say, phew. You know, it's not us. Yeah. And you have organizations contacting you, say that someone's been scraping my content on my website, and that's against my terms of service. And can you slap those people on the wrist? And then people say, you know, someone's been abusing journal access, and you know, someone's been downloading pirated movies and all this kind of stuff. Jeez. So you have all that firefighting to do as well. But anyway, so the policies you have to, you know. Who does get access to what? How tight do we tie things down? How much resources do we give people and that kind of stuff? So the IT department have to be involved in that. And it's the kind of thing you end up working with the consequences of, if not always getting your way in terms of what the policy will be.
So you're the right people to work on those kinds of things.
Yeah.
You just don't have to like it.
Yeah, ultimately it'd be management to make the final call, but it's going to be based on recommendations from sysadmins and our managers and up the line.
Okay.
And then I guess the last one is a very nebulous thing, but it's actually part of a sysadmin's job to stay in the know. you have to read RSS feeds. You have to know what's happening in technology. You need to know what's coming online. You need to know what's going on from terms of security. IT moves so fast that you just can't afford not to know what's going on. So believe it or not, reading the register is part of your daily work.
The register?
Right. Okay. The register is a really good UK-based tech blog.
Oh, okay.
Like Slashdot.
Okay.
Only UK-based. But Slashdot's fine too. And one of the reasons that Security Lite doesn't cost me any effort is because that's exactly the kind of stuff I have to do for work. I have to know what's going on for work. So it's easy for me to just, as well as making a note of it in work, to also make a note of it in an Evernote and say, talk about this with Allison on Saturday.
So it's actually your job. That's cool. Yeah. So now, how did you end up in this job from school, though?
So I first, immediately after graduation, I went into what was in theory going to be a PhD course. And that was, there was no official funding from an outside agency, but the department was funding postgrads, so there was an income. So it was all hunky-dory for about a year, and then that income completely dried up because the department ran out of money. And then there was an external funding source created, and then they only wanted new people. They didn't want people who'd already done a year, so there was no money available. So I started my own little sort of part-time company, and eventually it all got a bit annoying, and I hadn't quite finished the PhD. Well, I still haven't.
We met right around that time.
I think so, yeah. And then I set up my own little company, and I did some stuff on the side, which gave me a lot of experience, a lot of very varied experience, which is great. But then eventually a job came up in the computer center, and it was a contract position for 3 years or something. I applied for it, and I got it, and I'm pretty sure I got it based on the stuff I did outside of college rather than the actual basic degree. And then that became a permanent position, and that's that, really.
Now, one of the things I was going to say, I'm not a sysadmin, but I used to have sysadmins working for me, and my sense of the truly great ones are the ones with a scientific degree. Not necessarily that what they, you know, their physics course helps them do their job, but through a scientific degree, you're taught scientific methods. You're taught to do, you know, a trial and error method with controls on it. Let me change one thing at a time. Let me document what I did. More process-oriented to try to find solutions when something weird goes on. And an ability to do that kind of critical thinking is really honed in a scientific program. I know good sysadmins, I know adequate sysadmins who didn't get a college degree, but the truly great, the ones that really stand out and they become the crazy good person at it, those are the ones that went to college.
Yeah, I'd agree with that.
Specifically a scientific degree.
Well, I mean, okay, I say that you don't, it's not the case that you can walk out of a computer science degree and know enough to start work as a sysadmin, because that's just not true.
Two different jobs.
If you've done an actual computer science degree rather than a software engineering degree or something, what you've learned is the theory that underpins it all. You've learned none of the practicalities. But having that theory there, A, makes it easier to learn the practicalities, and B, means that when something goes wrong, you understand what's actually gone wrong at a low level rather than just sort of panicking, I guess. You've learned the critical thinking from the science degree, and you understand what's happening conceptually. So when funny things start happening, you're much better able to make sense of them because you have the basics. So a computer science degree is really important, but it's not enough.
Right. And again, a lot of the sysadmins I'm talking about didn't necessarily have a computer science degree. They might have an engineering degree. And that would help them just, again, because of the critical thinking and the controlled experiments and that sort of thing. They wouldn't know as deep a level what's going on as you would. But they know how to solve problems. That's what they've been taught to do. The people who don't have scientific degrees, a lot of people have degrees but non-scientific degrees, they tend to do a little more just trial and error. Just, oh, let me do this. Let me change these eight things. And then, okay, great. Now you don't know how you fix it, so you don't know what's going to happen next time.
Yeah, absolutely. That's probably the worst possible thing you can do is accidentally fix something and not know how you did it understand why.
One thing I've also always said is your maturity level in system administration can be measured by how much you believe it is 100% a science. Because when you first get out of school and you first start doing it, you think, these are ones and zeros, right? It's 100% science, right?
Deterministic.
Remember that? It was deterministic. And then you get to a certain point in your career where you have this horrible revelation that it's about 20% black magic. I think when you're fully mature, it's around 26% black magic, because there are just some times where there's just something that is never explainable. It can't be happening, what's gone on.
It annoys you more and more, though.
Yes, it does. Well, but then you also do get a level of maturity where you go, you know what? It stopped. Okay, moving on.
Sure, you do have to know when to let go sometimes, but it really goes against your scientific upbringing.
Yeah, it should
not
still
bother you. Try to get to the bottom of it. Yeah, it always bothers you when there's something funny afoot. And it actually stays in the back of your mind. And 4 years later, the black magic can suddenly be revealed in a moment of epiphany. It's like, oh my God, that's what was happening that day.
Well, I hope that does happen. We had a server that was servicing people all over the country. It was hundreds and hundreds of users accessing the server. And it started rebooting in the middle of the night. And we did everything to the server, Bart. I mean, we replaced every single hardware component in it. We upgraded software. We tracked things. We even put a camera in the server room to see if by any chance the cleaning people were unplugging it, plugging it back in when they plugged in the vacuum.
That's where I thought the story was going.
that's what it felt like. I mean, because it was like 2 a.m. every couple of weeks. And this went on for, I would say, 6 months, Bart. We never figured it out. And one day, it just stopped happening.
Oh, that'd drive me mad.
It was like 5 years ago. I'm still irritated by that.
No, for me, you progress as a sysadmin when you've done something, when you've broken something very badly. Because you learn so much from that experience.
Yeah. Oh, definitely.
I think my worst whoopsie, which was fixable, thankfully, but I accidentally, in one fell stroke by the misplacement of one character, knocked every single solitary host out of our domain.
Oh my goodness.
6,000 people could not log in. Their machines had simply been booted from the domain. They weren't on the domain anymore. It was a disaster. The help desk exploded.
Oh my gosh, that's funny.
It was the panic, the sense of panic when you realize, you know, you hit what you think is a really small command that's going to delete about 5 hosts because they need to be deleted. You hit return, and it should be a second, but the prompt doesn't come back. And then it's 5 seconds. Okay, something bad happened here. And then it gets up to 15, 20 seconds. And then eventually the prompt comes back and you say, I've deleted more than 5. How many more than 5? I don't know, but I've deleted more than 5.
Oh my gosh.
And then the phone explodes. And then you go, oh, I deleted them all. Yay.
Oh my gosh, that's horrible.
Yeah, and then you test your backups. And in our case, we passed the test.
Oh, that's good. Yeah, I was working with a sysadmin once when she hit RM space star.
Oh, I did that on a Mac once. It was very funny. I left out a forward slash by mistake in my programming, and I started at applications, and I just started watching these things nuke by. So I hit Control C, but I'd lost Adium and a bunch of other things beginning with A, B, and C.
Oh my gosh.
But the system was still up because it had started in the applications folder and hadn't got much further. But that was a really, really buggy system from henceforth.
Oh, I bet. Things were just a little bit jinky, huh?
Yeah. So, but anyway, it's a certain cold sweat that you will only ever get by doing something horrifically, terribly bad as a sysadmin. It's a unique feeling of dread, but you learn so much.
Sort of a growth thing that everybody has to do once.
Well, yeah, because I thought I was going to get in really big trouble. And my one-up superior just looked at me and went, I'm not going to tell you what I did when I was new, but trust me, it was worse.
Actually, I do remember working on a project where my boss, who was the genius, he was the golden boy, he could do no wrong, and then he dropped a screwdriver on a $17,000 mirror. And I just looked at him and said, thank you so much, because I'm never going to screw up that bad.
Yeah, it's like the first year physics student who blows up the high voltage source that cost $500,000 or something like that.
Oh, jeez. Well, this has been pretty cool, Bart. I learned a lot more about you than I even knew.
Oh, there we go. I learned a lot about me as well by writing these show notes. I was kind of surprised at how much I do in work.
How did I get this, huh? Well, maybe yeah. your coworkers might not agree. They think you're a big deadbeat, right?
You'd have to ask them.
All right. Well, we've gone on long enough here. I hope you have a good weekend with your family. It sounds like you're going to have some fun.
No, it should be fun. I don't even want to say how long it's been since I've been home.
Bad boy.
That's what Mom said.
All right. We'll talk to you in a couple weeks, Bart.
Okay. Until next time, happy computing.
Well, I have to officially say to Stu and Bart, I officially have to stop mocking IMP Live because now we've gone an hour and 38 minutes. Look how much great it is when I don't do any work. This is awesome. Well, we better wrap up the show after this long. I hope you enjoyed it. I had a great time. I got to play in the live chat room over at podfeet.com/live. So if you ever want to come over and join the crew, it's a lot of fun. This time, like I said, I didn't have to do any work. I got to play in the chat room while they listened to a bunch of the recordings. So that was a really good time. If you have a product you're really excited about, try your hand at a review yourself. I do have to confess, it's harder than you think, but it's a great way to give back to the show. If you have any questions about how to do it, just give me a holler and I'll give you some pointers. If you have any other kinds of questions, dumb or otherwise, comments or suggestions, just shoot me an email at allison@podfeet.com. Be sure to follow me on Twitter at twitter.com/podfeet. That's a lot of fun. It's so much fun to follow people on Twitter. We have a great time. You get to meet great people in this weird kind of way. It's impossible to explain, but you should check it out if you haven't done Twitter yet. Until then, thanks for listening and stay subscribed.